This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The sea has always been a relatively anarchic place. Piracy continues to be a menace. Ships have been attacked by terrorists, and the threat remains that terrorists could transport their weapons by sea. My guest, William Longavisha, says it has grown increasingly difficult for governments to control the oceans. He explains why in his new book, The Outlaw Sea, A World of Freedom, Chaos, and Crime. Longavisha is national correspondent for the Atlantic Monthly. His other books include Inside the Sky, reflections on his experiences as a professional pilot, and American Ground, about the cleanup at Ground Zero and the culture that developed around it. He's currently working on a series of articles on the rebuilding of the Iraqi justice system. Longavisha says more than 40,000 large merchant ships are wandering the world with little or no regulation under the system that's become known as flags of convenience. I asked him to describe that system.
It started with World War II as an American governmental invention, in fact, to get around our own neutrality laws and to be able to provide goods to Great Britain and in the years before we joined the war. We decided to take a lot of our own ships and flag them as Panamanian ships. This was, of course, Panama was really essentially a colonial state of the United States at that time. And so we felt we could maintain control, and we did, and it was very effective. And after the war, that spread. But starting in the 1980s, especially, in fact, ironically, just at the time when the United Nations, the IMO, was trying to address the organic growth of these artificial flags, there was an explosion of this, an indirect reaction, I believe, to the explosion of regulations, in fact. This became the only way to do business on the high seas. If you didn't do this, starting in the 1980s, it was no longer a choice, really, I think, for ship owners. If you didn't do it, you couldn't compete. The margins are razor thin. And you needed to milk the most efficiency out of your ships, which means that you needed to employ very cheap crews, and you needed to do minimal training and minimal maintenance on these ships, and just milk every ounce of efficiency from the operation if you wanted to survive in that business. It started in the 1980s, and it has grown since then.
Well, say I have a ship. What's the difference to me financially and in terms of the regulations I have to follow if I put a Liberian flag on versus if I put an American flag on it?
Well, the American flag, like many of the European flags, is quite extreme in that it requires American crews. In other words, there are union rules. So the first thing is that your labor costs are much, much cheaper if you go to a third world country. Operationally, the regulations are very similar. Between the American rules about how you should operate and maintain your ship and, let's say, Liberian rules or Maltese rules or Tongan rules, Bolivian rules, they're all about the same, and they're all based on the IMO, the United Nations system out of London. The difference is in the enforcement. In the United States, the Coast Guard definitely enforces the regulations. So you not only have to comply with the regulations, whereas in other places, in the most egregious flags of convenience states, there is really no regulation.
So one of the problems that this flag of convenience system causes is that a lot of the ships aren't in as good shape as they ought to be sailing the seas. What are some of the other problems?
You know, I think that you can talk about flags of convenience as being a terrible, terrible problem. I'm not sure that it is. I mean, I'm really an observer rather than a worrier about this system. Mm-hmm. In some ways, I think we can celebrate the freedom and the internationalization that it represents. It certainly is a problem if you are a U.S. Sailor and you want to make a living. The flags of convenience means pretty much that you can't. Now, there's an exception to that. U.S. ships doing business within the United States from a U.S. port to another U.S. port are required by law to fly American flags and hire American crews. But that's limited business. Flags of convenience, from an American sailor's point of view, is a very bad thing because it means you don't have a job anymore. You better find some other line of work. From an environmentalist point of view, it certainly does lead to low-quality ships that have a habit of breaking apart suddenly because they're so old, typically in a storm, and spilling, in the case of spilling oil, for instance, crude oil or the products of oil, causing massive pollution. Ships would be doing that anyway. The Exxon Valdez, the famous American tanker that broke up in Prince William, that ran aground in Prince William Sound and spilled a lot of crude, was an American flag ship with an American crew. It was sailing from one American port to another. So there's not a direct relationship between flag of convenience and a huge problem with the environment, but there's a rough relationship. Should we worry about that? I'm not much of an environmentalist personally. I don't worry too much about that. I think there are other things that we can worry about before we worry about the occasional oil spill, certainly though Europe has been blanketed by oil spills in recent years.
But it also seems that aboard a lot of these ships, you have a very multicultural staff, which sounds great, you know, multicultural crew, but the fact is that a lot of them can't communicate with each other, and if there's an emergency, that's a real problem.
There have been cases of ships running aground where afterward and during the investigation it has been found that essentially the captain couldn't talk to the crew. That's, I think, rare, and some form of broken English seems to be the universal maritime language on these ships. So I think, generally speaking, that is not a huge problem. From a God's eye view, from God's perspective, this multinationalism is probably a good thing. I mean, all people are created equal, and the idea that the good jobs, or the jobs in general, should be the preserve of the West probably is questionable from God's point of view, if you know what I mean.
You do make some of these ships sound like multicultural floating sweatshops.
Well, they are. But of course, one person's sweatshop is another person's opportunity, and that's one of the problems we face. We face when looking at the ocean and when looking at the economies on land. So that who are we? I try, in a way, to say in this book, without lecturing the readers, to impose Western standards of labor on third world people. If that imposition means, in fact, if not in principle, in fact, that we take the jobs away from them and give them back to ourselves.
William Longavisha is my guest, and he's our correspondent for The Atlantic. His new book is called The Outlaw Sea, A World of Freedom, Chaos, and Crime. One of the issues you write about is piracy at sea. And, piracy, I suppose, is related in some way to terrorism, too, because pirates can be terrorists. Piracy can become terrorism. Terrorism can be a form of piracy. And certainly we've already faced some acts of terrorism at sea, such as when the USS Cole was blown up by al-Qaeda in 2000, 11 months before September 11th. You say in your book that bin Laden is said to control up to 20 aging freighters. How much do you know about that?
I know very little about it. I think no one knows much about it. This is typical of the sea and of the world in which we live. It's very large, very complex, very easy to hide in. But it is, I think, generally thought that he does control freighters. There is one known case in 1998 in Tanzania of an al-Qaeda ship delivering explosives, which were then used in the embassy bombings. So this is, and there are other cases that are known. So for the transport of weapons or the transport of people, there is evidence that that bin Laden personally has been involved. Now, aside from that, he simply seems to be in the shipping business. I mean, much of what is transported on al-Qaeda ships, such as they are at any given month as they're traded and bought and sold, much of what is transported is just regular stuff, bulk, grain, and chickens for all I know. And for reasons of business and way of making money. And in the fit is natural and quite beautiful in a way. In other words, what interests me about this is the correlation or the similarity between the methods of business of regular ship owners, of this new form of extranational terrorist, and of this new form of extranational piracy. And these are sort of subsets. I mean, there are many terrorists in the world, and we use that word much too loosely these days. But if you look at the specific al-Qaeda form of terrorism, in which territory is really not the issue, and you look at this new form of piracy in which the groups involved are multinational, ephemeral, always changing, and are not tying themselves down by national allegiances. And you look at the way normal ships operate, you find a striking similarity. The purposes, of course, are quite different.
What is the new kind of piracy that you're talking about?
It's a subset of the sort of piracy. I mean, piracy has always existed, and I think there are reasons that can be explained why over the last 5 to 10 years there's been an upsurge of sort of hand-wringing type of journalism in which we're bemoaning the rise of piracy. I think that's largely bogus. Most piracy is the old kind of piracy, which amounts to poor people sitting on a shore, seeing the wealth of the world go by and jumping out in little boats, outboard motors, going out there, hitting the ships as best they can, stealing things from the crew, maybe a little bit of cargo, and disappearing. Opportunistic acts that are similar to street crime. That's not very interesting, and that's always existed. And so that gets reported a lot, and all of these things get blurred, and as I say, there's much hand-wringing going on. But inside that, those numbers, is this other form of piracy that I report on in this book, and that is numerically not significant, but structurally significant. And that is, these are basically multinational gangs, much more sophisticated, that exploit national laws, that use laws and citizenship to hide in rather than running away from. And are quite sophisticated in the use of airlines, passports, and equipment. And they tend also to be ambitious. This goes hand in hand with the other. And they tend, rather than simply stealing a little bit, they steal the whole thing. So they take the whole ship, and they steal they unload the cargo into the black market somewhere, and that's a lot of cargo. And then they take the ship, and they may change the name. They may then pose as a legitimate ship, do business somewhere in the world, grab another load of cargo as a legitimate ship, disappear with that, and eventually maybe sell the ship or just beach it somewhere, finally. So they're in the habit often of killing the entire crew. These are very, very dangerous people.
You give an example in your book of the Alondra Rainbow, a ship that was captured by pirates. And as you say, you know, the pirates, they renamed the ship, they reflagged the ship, they disguised the ship, and no one could find it for quite some time. Who were the pirates who took the ship?
Typically, the trigger men, so to speak, the ones who put their feet on the decks. They came up the stern of the ship in Indonesia. This was in the last few weeks of 1999. In fact, when they hit that ship, it was loaded, headed for Japan. The crew was both Filipino, and the captain and first engineer, I believe, captain and first engineer were Japanese. Ship was flagged in Panama, and it disappeared. The crew was put after being held on another ship, a pirate ship, for a few weeks. They were put into a life raft and abandoned for dead. By chance, after 10 days in this life raft, they were rescued by a Thai fishing boat. But the ship had disappeared, and there had been quite a search mounted by various navies, including aircraft, for this ship, and it had simply disappeared. This would seem sort of to be a surprise to somebody who looks at a map and says, "Well, how can the modern world with technology such as it is, and satellites, and this and that, how can a ship disappear?" The minute you get out on the ocean and begin to contemplate the actual size and turbulence of that mass of water, it becomes much easier to understand how a ship like that could disappear.
The pirates who took the Alondra Rainbow successfully hit it by repainting it, renaming it, reflagging it, and so on, but eventually it was discovered. Were the pirates ever brought to trial?
The Indians chased them. The Indian Coast Guard chased them in international waters. On a two- or three-day fight, during which they were simply shooting up the ship. The pirates were hiding in the engine room. The ship was proceeding at full speed on autopilot. They finally were forced to stop, and they were boarded. The Indian Coast Guard boarded them and arrested this crew of pirates. They took them to Mumbai, otherwise known as Bombay, and there was a trial. This trial was the first, at least in modern times, maybe ever, of a true international trial of international pirates. It's a complicated subject, but it was a landmark trial. And through the very slow process of Indian justice, they were finally convicted. And they were sent to prison in a city called Pune outside of Mumbai. I went to see them in the prison and talked to them about their experience.
My guest is William Longavisha. His new book is called The Outlaw Sea. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is William Longavisha, national correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly. His new book is called The Outlaw Sea, A World of Freedom, Chaos, and Crime. So you've learned a little bit about piracy. Are the laws getting tightened at sea as a result of terrorism now? Are there more controls?
Yes, there are, and that's one of the things that interests me. I mean, the growth in laws related to security after 9/11 at sea is in many ways parallel to or similar to the growth in laws, the general growth in maritime laws that have been issued by the United Nations, the IMO in London. And it's one of the paradoxes of this story that governments really have no choice but to act as governments, so that the American reaction to the very real threat of terrorism coming at us from the sea via ship has been willy-nilly simply to create these regulations and to work through the existing structures of regulations like the IMO, which have proved to be meaningless, actually. And the people who are involved in this, in the security field in the United States, off the record, most of them will admit that that really these regulations are not going to be effective, and that this you cannot stop a terrorist attack from the sea because of the nature of the sea. You cannot stop a terrorist attack with yet more regulations. But in a way, they really have no choice. I mean, they've been, especially in the Coast Guard, they've been given the job of protecting American shores, and this is what they have to work with.
Do you think that another terrorist attack against the United States at sea is inevitable?
Not inevitable, but I think it's certainly one of the avenues available to terrorists to attack the United States, and in a big way, because of course a ship can carry a lot of material. The ship itself can be one hell of a weapon if it blows up in a harbor. And more, I think, significant, a ship can be used, given the sort of the anarchy and the difficulty of seeing what's going on in the ocean in normal business. A ship can be used to bring things into the United States, like devices, weapons. It can be used very well, because anything can be brought into the United States relatively easily via ship, much easier than bringing it in on an airplane, or for that matter, bringing it overland through our ports of entry across the Rio Grande or something like that.
Now, one of the pieces in your new book is about a subject I'd really given absolutely no thought ever in my life to until I read your piece. That's about what happens to large ships when they're obsolete, when they're ready to be scrapped or junked. There's a part of the world that a lot of them go to now to meet their fate. What part of the world is that?
India and Bangladesh. In fact, they're in more than just a part of the world. There are two beaches. There's one in India called the Lang, another in Bangladesh, just north of the big port of Chittagong. And the ships are sold to scrap dealers. They're rammed up onto these beaches, onto these shores, and they're torn apart by armies of the poor. And you're driving through farm fields, typically dusty, poor Indian peasants in the fields, poking at this parched earth, very Indian scene. And suddenly, beyond a tree line on a certain dirt track, suddenly you see the superstructure of a huge ship. It's as if the ship is growing out of the earth. It rises above the trees. It's a very unlikely thing suddenly to come upon. You go beyond the tree line, and it all unfolds in front of you. It's a Lang, and for miles along this coast, there is one ship after another, it's stretching into the horizon, I mean, down the beach by hundreds of these ships. And they're huge because they've come out of the water. They've been rammed up on the shore. So you see the true size of these machines. And they are in various states of deconstruction. I mean, they're being torn apart by hand.
By hand and like hammer?
Crowbar, hammer, and cutting torches using cooking gas, which is a low-temperature form of cutting torch. And mostly simply by sweat and willingness to work and willingness to take risks.
William Longavisha is national correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly. His new book is called The Outlaw Sea, A World of Freedom, Chaos, and Crime. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.